Hi, friend. It's Brittany Moses.
And Ranella Kalagithi.
And you're listening to Speaking Our Minds, the podcast that brings you honest and nuanced conversations around mental health, holistic wellness, and the real complexities of what it means to be human in the challenges of today's world, where we have fun, fascinating, and meaningful discussions around how to live a more insightful, connected, and whole life from the inside out. Joined by guest professionals, thought leaders, and some of my friends and those with lived experience. As always, we ask that you keep in mind that the views and opinions shared here are respectively held by each individual and is not a substitute for professional care or an alternative to seeking personal help from your clinician or provider and is ours to discern. We're so glad you're here. Follow the conversation on Instagram at SpeakingOurMindsPod and sit with us because we're diving in. This podcast episode is brought to you by WeShare by UHSM, a unique healthcare membership on a mission to create holistic wellness for the mind, body, and spirit. I'm honored to partner with UHSM and its community of faithful members. Together, we plan to create more awareness and programs around mental health and the role it plays in our overall balanced health. If you or someone you know is frustrated with their current healthcare, I encourage you to inquire about membership options at www.weshare.org or call 1-800-900-8476.
Welcome back to another episode of Speaking Our Minds. This is Ranella.
And Brittany.
And man, this month is going to be a really interesting month. Happy March, everyone. This is a really special month for us because we decided to talk about something that can be kind of difficult to talk about, but I think is a really important part of our development as humans, and especially coming from a faith background. And so this month, we are talking all about evolving faith and building healthy spirituality. And Brittany and I actually really connected on this topic when we first started talking and getting to know each other, because we have very similar stories and backgrounds. And we wanted to share some of those stories today. And of course, we have a bunch of people that we work with that are experiencing shifts and changes in this area of life, and it can be kind of scary. And so today we're going to talk about some common tactics, even in spiritually abusive situations. So we're going to kind of go deep into this. We'll talk about unhealthy religious communities. And at the same time, what's normal to feel when we're going through developmental stages of deconstruction. And I know that word comes with so many different meanings, so much that can feel really, you know, unstable or scary. And we just kind of want to normalize the whole experience. And again, everything we share is kind of our own opinions, our own experience, and also how it relates to our mental health, which is the main reason we're talking about this. So anyway, that's a very long preamble, but it's going to be a big month.
Yeah, I think that this is something that we're seeing a lot happening in our culture and our society, and it's not anything new. You know, this idea that people, as they get older, they're going through shifts in their faith, which from my perspective is developmental. You know, as you get older, as you experience more of life, as your brain develops, you know, I think it's very normal to shift from black and white thinking to seeing things and people from a more holistic perspective and being able to integrate all of those experiences forward. But for some people, this can seem very fearful, even just the idea of, you know, thinking for yourself or thinking more critically through things. It can seem like a threat to faith, but I don't think it has to be. It absolutely plays a role in our mental health. Just thinking about spirituality, right? I've always said from the beginning that we are biopsychosocial spiritual beings. And I'm really excited mm-hmm. that there is a lot of research and evidence that is coming out that is showing how faith and spirituality plays a role in our mental health. For example, I just read the book, The Awakened Brain by Lisa Miller, which is really fascinating.
I love it.
Oh my gosh.
I have it right here too.
Oh my gosh. I'm holding I'm holding it in my hands. And, you know, she hasn't come from a specific religious context. She's just kind of talking about faith in general. But one of the things that they found was that, you know, our brains can become structurally healthier and better connected, you know, when we're able to kind of have these spiritual capacities that exist where we experience love and connection and unity and a sense of guidance and dialogue with life. And actually, we're able to access some psychological benefits like less depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and more positive psychological traits like grit, resilience, optimism, tenacity, and creativity that all play a role in spirituality. So if you have kind of this fractured spirituality, or you've been hurt spiritually or abused spiritually, it can cause a breakdown in all of these psychological and mental factors. If you're able to find a healthy community or a healthy, you know, faith life, it can add to all of these factors. And so that's why we're talking about this, because it is more than just, you know, theology or doctrine or what have you. We're more so kind of looking at the aspect of the effects that it has on our mental and emotional well-being, as well as our relationships, and normalizing some of the feelings that we have when we feel like some of that is breaking down, whether it's because our thinking has changed or because, you know, we have been hurt, abused, manipulated in these areas that have really detrimentally affected us. And this happens a lot. And so it would behoove us to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're bringing that up because in the context of what we're talking about this month, it is not a black and white way of, hey, let's break down everything that we grew up with and it's all bad. No, spirituality is so important to being a human. And especially coming from an Indian background and a Southeast Asian background, spirituality just encompasses everything in life. And I think sometimes in the West, we kind of create this strong line between what is spiritual and what is not. And, you know, in our culture, in Indian culture, I mean, it's in everything. And so this is not a series of episodes where we are wanting people to believe a certain way or go in a certain direction, but really to emphasize the importance of healthy spirituality and how powerful it can be in our lives, but in the sense that there is a healthy way to go about it, and there are definitely unhealthy tactics, mindsets, beliefs, ways of thinking that can really that have been very deeply that have been seeped into a religious framework, and so that's what we kind of want to kind of, you know, undo and bring to the surface.
And I know someone who might be thinking this might say, okay, well, what is the basis for something being healthy or unhealthy? And, you know, obviously, like we said, these are our journeys. These are our thoughts, feelings, opinions, you know, our experiences. It is up to everyone's discernment to decide what fits for them and what doesn't. But for me, it's always like, look at the fruit. You know, if it produces bad fruit, to me, that is the evidence that it is unhealthy. If it is leading to, you know, depression, if it is leading to suicidal ideation, if it is leading to harm to self and others, if it is leading to extreme shame, extreme guilt, alienation, isolation, fracturing of relationships, right? Just my belief is that, you know, if it is producing bad fruit, destructive fruit to your life and those around you, to me, that is evidence that maybe the framework or the ideology is not good for our soul or for humanity. That's obviously very broad. And like Ranella said, we are not here to tell you what to think, feel, or believe, because we also understand that everyone listening to this are coming from different places in your walk of faith and in your walk of life. And we really do want to be respectful of an understanding of where everyone is. And we also ask for the same grace and understanding as we're having this conversation. Maybe some aspects of this do apply to you. Maybe some aspects of this don't apply to you, but maybe at the very least, it will help provide a broader understanding and picture of where people are coming from in their experiences.
so that we can show love to neighbors, so that we can support one another in a holistic way that is rooted in love and that is rooted in the flourishing of all of us.
Yeah. So now you know what we're going to be talking about this month, and I think it deserves kind of that context. And so let's just begin with normalizing the developmental aspect of evolving faith and kind of starting to question and doubt. I think a lot of people, when they get into their mid-20s, just developmentally, your brain is starting to become more fully developed. You are starting to have the ability to not just think in black and white terms, right? And when we're thinking in black and white terms, all or nothing thinking really comes from a sense of trying to find predictability and safety, right? As we get older, as we continue to develop in our thinking, hopefully our mind starts to expand and it starts to become capable of holding multiple realities and truths at the same time. That proves to be very difficult and scary when you apply it to a faith context, especially if you're coming from a faith context that strongly thrives on black and white thinking. You know, a faith tradition, a faith belief, and there are many shades, so many shades. You know, we come particularly from Christianity, but no matter what religious background you're from, there is a lot of underlying fear that causes people to want to find that black and white, what's right, what's wrong. And that can be really difficult as your brain tries to grapple with being a human at the same time. But this is very normal as you get mm-hmm. into your 20s, your mid-20s, your late-20s, your 30s. If you are experiencing the questioning, the doubts, kind of looking around and saying, well, what I've grown up thinking and believing doesn't seem to match with the reality of being human, then join the club. You know, like that is part of becoming more mature and more emotionally intelligent. It's very normal to come to those stages of life, and it's good.
Yeah, I think what's been interesting for me is like I was in the church serving for years, as were you, in ministry with youth and young adults. And then, you know, being in the mental health field, it's really interesting the way that this is talked about, because in the world of psychology and mental health, we understand that it's very normal for your thinking in all aspects, not just faith, but in general, to go from this kind of simplistic black and white thinking you had as a child, because that was the stage of your brain development, to, as you get older, being able to integrate your experiences, integrate your understandings, being able to understand different factors, different aspects, and being able to process those things more right. critically. That is literally just a natural part of development of your brain, of human psychology as you get older. So it's really interesting when, yeah, you are in maybe these black and white communities or spaces where it's really frowned upon and it's really shut down to exercise those developmental stages, or even in a way it's stunted in a way, because you're not allowed to think in more holistic ways. So, you know, from the psychological perspective, emerging adulthood, ages like 18 to 29, you know, is when people are developing a more independent way of life, in the sense of like either going to college or a trade or a career, and you're beginning to expand more in life. And so Piaget, who's like a popular developmental psychologist who developed the theory of cognitive development, talks about this post-formal thought stage that's taking place. And it's the idea that thinking around this age naturally becomes more flexible and fluid in adulthood when a person is able to recognize opposing ideas or feelings and develop them into a more complete understanding, right? They're able to integrate more of their experiences into a whole perspective. In that stage, they're able to acknowledge contradictions that are existing in their reality. So, you know, it's normal, again, that your thinking is going to expand a bit more. I know for me, where that breakthrough kind of came through was actually when I was getting into mental health. But even before I got into the world and field of psychology, I was working with youth and young adults in ministry, and mental health crises kept coming up, like mental health challenges kept coming up. And the way that we were dealing with it was a very simplistic, kind of spiritually bypassing, black and white way of seeing and dealing with mental health. Like either anxiety or depression was like just a spirit, or it was just something that needed to be cast out, or you just need to pray, or you just need to read these scriptures, right? And I remember feeling a little helpless because I felt like I had the intuitive feeling that we did not have enough tools and resources and understanding about the complexities of what was going on with the mental health of some of these kids. And then I went through my own challenges with mental health, with depression and anxiety. And here I was a super faithful person in my beliefs. I believed, I prayed, I believed in scripture, like everything. And I still was struggling with my mental framework, even though I was checking off all the boxes. And so even within myself, I was like, there's something more going on here with the inner workings of the mind, of the brain, like environment, household, like all these things I was piecing together in my own life that could contribute to mental health. And that's when I was like, I don't think we have a full picture of the biopsychosocial aspects of this. And that kind of led me to looking at things on my own and then going to school. And then I learned more about the various factors of trauma and what have you, and also of research and thinking critically to have evidence-based approaches that lead to real solutions instead of just kind of like this abstract hoping and thinking, right? And so I think for me, that was a big experience for me where I realized, oh, like I've seen this area in such a black and white way.
Yeah.
There's so many other factors and so much more nuance to this. And what other aspects of life are nuanced in humanity, in people that maybe we're missing or thinking about in this black and white way?
Yeah, that is so interesting because you were working with people who were starting to experience mental health crises. And it's just like, oh, we don't really have the tools, or we're not really sharing things that are actually helpful and beneficial and supportive. And I think that's what happens when you divorce mental health and spirituality. Because when you think of the world of religion and spirituality, there's a lot of power there.
Yes.
There is a lot of power in the leadership and the leadership structures. You typically have a pastor, you have a priest, you have someone that's like kind of that spiritual leader, and everyone kind of following. And obviously in the world that we live in today, hopefully that leader is pointing you to spiritual ideas and principles versus to themselves. But sometimes that's not always the case. And sometimes spiritual leaders also are not, they haven't had training in how and how humans change behaviorally, you know, what that process is. And so we're always, especially in certain religious environments, you know, that have an emphasis on shifting and changing human behavior. There's a lot of emphasis on that sometimes. And so the way the tactics that are used to shift human behavior, if they're not informed by, you know, an understanding of psychology and behavioral health and things like that, then you can actually be doing harm. And yeah, I think that was a little bit of my story as well, you know, just coming to a point in my life, you know, like you, Brittany, I was a really strong leader in my community, in my religious community. And I would say there was a little emphasis on the spiritual aspect, but a lot of it was focused on, did you read your Bible? Are you having devotions? Did you, you know, are you for, and in my particular religion, denomination, it was a lot of emphasis on like what you eat and you don't eat. There was a lot of shame around that too, in my specific subculture. And it almost was like all of these outward, external, performative things were what showed you whether you were quote unquote spiritual or not, versus it being a very personal experience. And so when I left that world in around, you know, physically left that world in 2017, it was very difficult to exist as a human, like trying to understand myself when I was 27, 28, and still trying to live by some of those very stringent boxes, rules. It was almost impossible. It was either I am, you know, because that's what happens when there's a very strong line.
Yeah.
You're either on this side doing all of the right things, all of the things that lead to you being a good spiritual person that loves God, that God loves, you know, I'm reading my Bible, praying, telling people about God. I am evangelizing, even like in the workplace and in, you know, public environments. I am, you know, not eating this, not doing that, not drinking this, not, it's lots of the rules stuff. So it's either you're on this side of the fence and you're good and you feel proud of yourself, you feel accepted by God, or like there's like no middle ground. It's like, or you're not reading your Bible every day. Oh my gosh, really, really bad. Really, you know, like that's danger, danger, danger. You aren't evangelizing. Oh, you're not a spiritual person. You know, there are all these ideas connected to the things that you were doing or not doing. Like, oh, you know, in my world, it was like, you're eating meat even. Okay, so that's the world I came from. It's like, oh, you're eating meat, you're eating dairy. Oh, well, that's like, you know, you must not care about your temple, like what God has. So it was all these ideas and beliefs that were connected to externals. So again, just normalizing that experience and thinking about my own, it's almost impossible to feel like a good Christian or a good human when your beliefs start to expand, when you start, you know, becoming more inclusive, when you start wanting to treat people with love and kindness and generosity. You know, that was so difficult for me. And in many ways for myself, I, you know, when I was around 28, 29, I had to just start kind of dropping some of those externals that I had placed so much pressure on. And in dropping some of those things, it definitely spiraled me into a place where I was like, am I still spiritual? Do I love God? Am I a good person? Yeah. Do I even, you know, like, am I going down this path of destruction? Of course, all those questions and everything were there because of the beliefs that were so tightly tied to external behaviors and ways of interacting and believing about the world around me. And very, very difficult to feel like a good person when you're going through that.
Interesting. Yeah. I think I hit ahead in my 20s too, at the end of my 20s too, or mid 20s, because of the performative aspects that you're talking about. I realized how performative my faith was and how much it was proving that I was a good and faithful person to everyone else. And as much as we don't like to talk about it or say this, there is a lot of externalizing and a lot of, I want other people to see how good and faithful I am. And we can do it under the guise of, oh, I'm just trying to be a good example, you know, but then what happens is, you know, and I think this has been the biggest shift in my own faith is that it is way more personal and it is way more like unseen. Like, I don't feel like I have anything to prove. Like, it's, you know, but before it was like, oh no, I need to show up in this way, this way, and this way to show people that I am faithful. And, you know, and especially if you were like a leader or what have you. And so I think what happens is, like, developmentally, now I was raised in the church. My parents were young adult ministry leaders when I was born into this world. So I was like born into it. I was the kid in the pews. Yeah, and I think that there, because you're a pastor's kid. So, like, I think there is a phase where you do have to kind of find it for yourself because it's everything that's been handed to you. And it's every, you know, it's all the beliefs that have been handed to you and all the ways of thinking that have been handed to you. And for it to become authentic and for your faith or spirituality to become your own, I think there does have to be a breaking down, a critical thinking, a questioning that takes place that says, what parts are me and what parts did I hold on to because they were socially acceptable, what parts of my faith are socially constructed because it was what was handed to me. It was what was approved of. It was what was praised and applauded whenever I showed up this way. So I think what happened for me in my 20s is I did realize that while I'm not going to say it wasn't true, I do believe that what I felt and experienced was true, but I do also feel like a lot of it was performative and a lot of it was socially constructed, not intentionally, but I think naturally, because the way we know that the way that human behavior works is that we continue behaviors that are approved of, that are applauded, that are reinforced. That's what I was thinking, that are socially reinforced with positive behaviors. That's literally how behaviors are kind of created. When we have positive reinforcement, that tells us that is a good thing.
Right.
It's praise. So keep doing it, you know, because you're getting the positive reinforcement. And then on the reverse, if you get negative reinforcement, like if you say or think or do this thing, you're going to be ostracized. You're going to be, you know, discounted. You're going to be punished. You're going to be, you know, socially reprimanded. Then you, oh, that's bad. Don't do that.
Right.
And so what can happen is your behaviors can actually become more socially constructed by your environment and by people, because you're learning what's acceptable and not according to people, what gets praised and what doesn't. And you start conforming your behaviors around, you know, these social appraisals and approvals. And so I think that's very normal. I think that's very easy to do. I think also in when you're like, especially a young person of faith, you can kind of overcompensate by being like super zealous.
And, oh, yeah, 100%.
You know, right? Like you have so many performative behaviors where everything you're doing is like, you know.
Oh, and can we connect that to like the fact that whatever you're going through personally in your life, if you are already vulnerable to needing validation, acceptance, praise, you know, like that could also lend itself to really getting sucked into that mindset and that kind of that reinforcement, you know, kind of pleasing the leaders above you and wanting to be accepted. I mean, that's just huge.
Yes. So I do think this thing happens, at least I know it was for me and probably for you and a lot of people, where you hit a wall at some point where you realize either the ways that you're performing are primarily works-based, you know, or it's primarily driven by being accepted, being liked, or what have you. And it's not like super sustainable, you know, I'm operating in this way. And I feel like the performative parts just kind of lessen. At least they did for me. We're just like, you know what? I'm not going to live a performative spirituality, a performative faith. Like, this is a personal experience, whether or not people see me doing this or that. Like, that does not define me or my faith or my beliefs, you know? And so it kind of, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is it goes from being externalized to more internalized. And for me, that is the distinction between healthy faith and kind of unhealthy faith in my own life, is like, what is the drive, you know?
Yeah. No, and that makes sense, because as developmentally as you stopped caring in general,
right.
You know, stopped needing the validation. So that's, you know, that process of individuating yourself in general, apart from religion, spirituality, everything, just developmentally, you begin to be okay with who you are. And that allows you to start forming your own interpretations and ideas and understanding. And but that again presents a problem when you come from a mentality, a religious, spiritual context where having individuality is seen as a threat.
Right.
And I would say that that is where I kind of came from. Again, with my family, my dad as a pastor, our pastor's family, we were not like that. But in the community that I found myself in, very much focused on kind of fitting into the box. And so if you're listening to this right now and you are not fitting into the box and you are afraid and the first thing that comes up for you is fear, very normal.
Yeah.
Very like that is, you know, when you're afraid of what people might think of you, how people might judge you, you're afraid of where you're headed. You're afraid of, you know, and I want to also emphasize the fact of where that fear comes from. That fear actually, you know, we experience fear when we don't have clarity and when we don't have a sense of safety, right? All throughout your life, the fact that you're experiencing fear when you're deconstructing or when you're evolving in your faith, the very fact that you're experiencing fear shows you that the foundation that you had your spirituality set on was a foundation of fear and not a foundation of security and safety and love. Because in general, we have to, as humans, find something that we can trust and something that we can, you know, really put our whole weight on. Up until this point, you might have been putting your full weight on fear. You've been putting your full weight on, I'm not going there because I've been told that that is what leads to the path of destruction. That is what leads to being too worldly. That is what leads to not being close to God. And now you're starting to hopefully create new ideas of what spirituality really means for you. And so anyway, I just think that that is so important to normalize, like the fear and even the shame that comes with it. The shame of like, you know, where am I going? Am I a good person? Will I be accepted? Are people talking about me? I had to go through that for so many years. And I think that the fact that you're experiencing that shows that maybe the communities you were a part of, the beliefs that you had adopted, were probably not therapeutic for you anyway. Therapeutic in the fact that spirituality is meant to buffer, support, and, you know, give you a sense of peace and calm, trust, safety, love. And if you had not experienced, you know, obviously you didn't experience that because now you're deconstructing certain aspects of your faith. And that's a really good thing.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the individuation part, because what I find is that there are a lot of people who do have a lot of either questions or doubts, or they're rethinking things, or they are unlearning and relearning things in a different way, maybe with a more holistic perspective. They're not seeing certain issues or things in a black and white way anymore, but they are afraid to talk about it. Like, they are afraid to bring it up in their community, or they don't want to bring it up in fear of what other people will think, or like you said, even in fear of like just them questioning. And so I think that's why it's important to bring up, because believe it or not, whether it's being made, you know, overt or not, there are people who are just not saying it, but their ways of thinking are developing right underneath, you know, the communities that they're in. And they're just afraid to express it because maybe that community does not do well with individuation and does not allow room and space for people to go through these developmental stages and normalize it instead of shaming it and being like, you know, oh, if you think this, or you're automatically deceived, you're automatically being led astray, you're automatically da 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 da. And it's just like, there isn't really room for development, for questioning, for, you know, having various perspectives, or the idea that other perspectives could be true, or at least are valid. You know, when there's no room for that, what happens is people feel like they do have to either fit in or out of the box, because there isn't really room for them to develop and grow, or even just be able to facilitate conversation that isn't automatically seen as threatening, you know? So that's why we're having this conversation, because we know that it's happening all the time.
All the time.
Other people might not be aware of it, maybe because they are in a community where there is an echo chamber, or it is a closed network where people aren't like vocalizing, or feel like it's safe for them to really vocalize some of the things that we're talking about that are taking place within them.
Yeah. And can I just say that it's been so healing to have you as a friend?
Oh my goodness.
You know, like to find someone that's also on that journey where you can have those discussions, because Brittany and I will talk about things and we might not always see every single thing eye to eye, but it's a safe space to just like express And I think as you get older, you have to find people like that because yeah. that's part of what it means to be human. And that's why I'm so excited about this month in general, because,
yes.
you know, the guests that we're going to have on, the conversations that we're going to have are going to go even deeper into some of these details. Like, this episode is really just an overview of, you know, some of the things that we're going to be talking about, because the layers run real deep.
Yes.
So maybe we should jump in and go ahead.
I just want to add another thing. Another thing that takes place for people is that they begin to see that their leaders are human or flawed, especially if there's a scandal, right? So sometimes that can break, right? That can break, that can kind of disorient someone when it comes to their faith, either because the person who is supposed to be the mouthpiece of God or what have you has either harmed or has abused, or there's been some type of scandal. And there is this incongruence now where you're like, wait, if this is a person of God, or if these are people of God and they are able to kind of live this double life and this thing happen, what does that mean for, you know, a person of faith or a person in leadership? And that can disorient people as well. And of course, people are imperfect. And I don't believe that people are the representative of God personally.
It's too much pressure.
And I do think that goes both ways, the way that someone elevates themselves and also the way that other people elevate them. And it kind of happens in this cycle where they feel like they need to continue like living up to the elevations and platforms in the ways that which people are elevating them. But that's a whole other conversation on leadership and authority. But it makes sense because, like we were saying with the developmental stages, in the beginning, we kind of are in this simplistic black and whiteness, or what would be considered dualism. This is actually according to William Perry's research on, you know, the journey through major stages of moral development that people go through. And he talks about going from dualism to multiplicity to relativism to commitment. And so in dualism, there is that black and white, more simplistic thinking, which makes sense when you're a child, where answers are fixed and you trust that authority figures have the final answers, which can be simple and definitive, right? You don't really question them. You know, also the world is broken up into people who have the answers and people who don't. And ironically, we happen to always be in the group of people who have them. You know, what a coincidence. And goodness, like you were saying earlier, is attained through obedience, hard work, and responding with all the right answers that are socially rewarded. And so that's that dualism stage in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then people move to multiplicity, where there might be a little uncertainty that's starting to come in because we've received new information or experienced new information that kind of challenges our reality and our former reasoning. And we might be facing some contradictions, and we might start realizing that our authorities don't have all the answers. And that might lead us to find, you know, answers from people maybe who have more information, are more skilled, are more expertise, are more developed in these things. And this transition from, you know, dualism to multiplicity, that simplistic black and white thinking is gone. You kind of can't go back to it. I know I can't, right? Once you understand that things are nuanced and complicated, you kind of can't go back to seeing things as just black and white. Your world is kind of opened up. And that's where it leads people to relativism. They start understanding that, okay, wait, like maybe there are other perspectives that could be either true or that are worth considering or are valid to other people. Like, it's valid to other people to have these other perspectives too.
I just have to interject because in the world that I came from, that word relativism was totally dog.
Same.
It was dog whistled.
Me saying it right now.
It's like triggered, exactly. Because it was dog whistled up front in sermons talking about people who, you know, this world that we live in that is postmodern and all the relativism and there are no absolutes, as if that was like the worst thing and that was what's causing people to leave God, when in fact the relativism is actually allowing people to have a much broader perspective of God and spirituality and actually adopt something that is a lot more therapeutic, and that's part of their development. So we're literally in some of these circles trying to like hinder people's developmental growth by shaming them for wanting to have a more expansive view of themselves mm-hmm. and humanity. And it's actually like very, it's very detrimental, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just a sad thing. It's detrimental to your development and mental health. So anyway, I'm so glad that you're going through each of these stages.
And to your relationships, because I think for me, yes. you know, what relativism does is it exposes you to the fact that other people have ways that they've grown up, ways that they have developed in their thinking that are just as real and valid to them. And so I think that creates empathy for other people to where you say, okay, like, I understand why you think this way, or it doesn't mean I agree with everything that everyone believes, right? But I can at least have the developed thinking to understand people in the world have different perspectives because of the logic of where their lives have brought them that makes sense to them in the same way that that mine has brought to me in my life experiences and upbringing and where I've landed. And so I think, you know, to completely thwart that, it's like, no, this is another stage that people go through. And it's actually a stage that opens people up to be more understanding and empathetic and interconnected to other people in a way that isn't always threatening. In a way that isn't always, oh, you're here, you landed here, you're bad, you're the, you know what I mean? You need to be able to hold these multiple perspectives, I think, to genuinely love people and have that understanding.
Because humans are complex.
Exactly.
Humans are complex. We all don't fit in one box, and there isn't one rule for everyone. So I'm so glad. I'm glad and you're bringing this up.
And then lastly, there is the commitment phase, which I find is really interesting. And this is when a person kind of stops fighting uncertainty and just kind of accepts, okay, there are going to be some things I know, and there are going to be some things that I don't know, you know, and they're able to, you know, choose their own path, whether it comes to their values, you know, their beliefs, or ideal that gives them structure. And it's basically where you say, okay, you know what, this is where I've landed, you know, in my faith, you know, given that I've experienced these things, I've understood these perspectives, I've integrated my understandings to this point, this is what I currently believe. And so that's kind of the commitment phase where you're like, okay, this is what I stand on. These are my values. These are my beliefs. You know, they've kind of evolved to this place. And it's possible that as you get older, they may continue to evolve. What you think you know now may change in 10 years, you know? But I say all that to say, these all are very normal stages that people go through. And it's not something to be feared. It just means that you're actually maturing and growing up mentally, emotionally, spiritually, to be able to integrate with the diversity of people in the world around you.
Right. No, this is so good. I think all of this context is really important because so much more than just the actual beliefs themselves that are changing or the perspectives themselves is the emotional experience of breaking free from that type of linear thinking. And linear thinking is very much something that is prevalent in Western thinking too, that very much black and white, there's one way or the other, us versus them. And when you start breaking out of that, there's so much freedom. There's so much joy and freedom, but there's a lot of fear and shame that precedes that, precedes that freedom to kind of break through. But I know also that you have, before I came on to the podcast, you have some episodes that are specifically focused on some of the more spiritually intense experiences, religious abuse, spiritual abuse. So maybe you could talk about that and what those episodes are, because there are some people that are listening that might actually have a very extreme experience. I think you and I had pretty extreme experiences, but there are even more extreme experiences than what we've had.
Yeah. So in previous episodes, we've definitely dove deeper into the topics of spiritual abuse and spiritual trauma, and specifically when spiritual language was used in the manipulation, in the abuse, in the trauma that can lead to that faith crisis. And so we have episode 69, When Faith Hurts, The Impact of Spiritual Trauma with Victor Veith. We have episode 64, Hope and Healing for Addressing Spiritual Abuse and Religious Trauma with Dr. Justin Holcomb. And Episode 42, Signs of Spiritual Abuse and Beginning Recovery with Dr. Diane Langberg, who is like a pioneer in this. And so we do have some other episodes to dive deeper into that, but we bring it up because a lot of, not all the time, but a major reason why a lot of people end up kind of going through these faith crises and rethinking their, you know, community, their ideals, their beliefs is because they've experienced some kind of breaking, some kind of harm or hurting in their spiritual context. And whether it's from a leader or just really disappointment and things that have happened, this is very real. And you know, it's important to bring up because I think that sometimes people will bypass this. They'll say, oh, you know, someone's beliefs or ideologies are changing just because they want to live in sin, or they just don't want to live biblical truth, or they just, you know, they, you know, humans hurt them, but it's not God. So like, you know, they kind of bypass these things and they don't really realize like, there's so many layers to this, whether it is developmentally with thinking in your brain, but also there could be harm, you know, that's causing people to kind of rethink the whole structure of things. And there is, you know, a crossing of boundaries or things aren't really aligning with, you know, what they believe to be true of the heart of what it means to love people. And that's been fractured by people who did these things in God's name. And so they have to rethink things. There's very real experiences that are very normal to lead to these things, especially when there are spiritually abusive situations.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you have those resources. And actually, I was just thinking on my Instagram, I have a highlight, a story highlight called Spirituality. And I share a few more of, you know, videos and carousels of how the religious girl gets into and gets out of identity crisis. And the good religious girl syndrome. If you want to kind of go into that a little bit more, I have some videos and I share a little bit even more deeply about my experience because there are very specific steps of how we kind of get into this identity crisis. And that's also part of the whole breaking down of everything, how it almost feels like our whole world is spinning because it's not just religious beliefs. It's a religious identity. It's a context and a construct of safety that we have built all around us. So when that starts breaking down, it can be a very disorienting experience. So definitely go back to those episodes. Go to my story highlight under spirituality that can kind of normalize your experience even more.
Yeah. And on that note, I think we wanted to talk a little bit about kind of some of those traits that you might see or feel that, at least for us in our experiences, kind of distinguished a healthy faith community versus maybe a more unhealthy and kind of destructive faith community. And we know, and we preface this knowing that no human community is going to be perfect. Humans are messy in any institution, you know, and we understand that. However, if it is more detrimental, like I said earlier, if the fruit is more detrimental than good, then it might be speaking to kind of the culture of the ideologies that are there that aren't leading to good fruit. So this can be gaslit sometimes, like, oh, you just don't want to hear it, or you just don't want to hear the truth, or you just don't want to, you know, it's because the truth makes you uncomfortable. And I just want to kind of rebuke that gaslighting. Okay. Like, because sometimes it's because something ain't right.
Yes. Like you got a gut intuition and you're listening to it.
Something ain't right, you know, and that is what's so difficult about spiritual manipulation and abuse is that it will separate you from your instinct. It will separate you from your intuition. It will separate you from yourself and the signs that are telling you something's not right here, the way they're talking, the way they're treating people, the way they're doing things. It's not rooted in love. It's hurting people. It's right. Like something in you is like, this is controlling or this is manipulative or the fruit is not adding up. You know, they've said a million prophecies and none of them are coming true, you know, but they're having you give all this money because these prophetic things are going to happen. But with there's nothing to show for it. I mean, I've heard countless stories. I've experienced countless stories, you know, and it's unfortunate because in these types of settings, you might be gaslit that, you know, you're not believing God enough or that you're not trusting enough or you're leaning on your own understanding. Or, you know, you'll kind of be gaslit that it's just you. And so I want to kind of empower people to take back the holy wisdom and discernment that also resides in them when something isn't right and that these signals are valid. Specifically in these spiritually abusive and manipulative situations that can kind of lead to the breaking off for people.
Yeah, I would almost say that if you are in an environment that downplays you listening to your own inner wisdom and gut instincts, it's not a safe space. And that's so hard to say because like it's really hard to say that out loud because you're like scratching your head. Do those voices exist? You know, like in a Christian context where actually even something like the Bible and a sacred text is placed above the person that God created. There's almost this idea that who you are is innately sinful, innately bad, always wanting to do you know, going towards all the quote unquote sinful things that are terrible for you. And if you place the Bible and its wisdom high above your own instincts, then you'll be safe. But really what I've found in my own development and my own understanding of spirituality is that that as a human, yes, we do have certain instincts that cause us to be overactive in seeking out pleasure, maybe seeking out too much pleasure that's not good for us, seeking it out in areas that are going to leave us broken. There's absolutely that aspect, but it isn't tied to whether I am a good human at my core, right? Because the Bible also says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. You know, the Bible also says that there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out all fear. And if we are trying to develop humans that are going to make good decisions about their health, their happiness, and their safety, we have to stop connecting this idea that we are just extremely innately terrible and bad and that we're always going to be. I mean, that's kind of like, that's anxiety inducing. That is not therapeutic. It, you know, it causes you to lean into more self-sabotage, which when you're speaking from a psychological, developmental, behavioral standpoint, self-sabotage does not actually lead to healthier behaviors and healthier choices. Actually, self-compassion does. Much more self-compassion, greater capacity to have unconditional positive regard for yourself. I mean, that's Carl Jung, right? Unconditional positive regard for yourself and for others. And if you are in a faith and spiritual community that is the opposite, where it is not unconditional positive regard for yourself and others, there's more of an emphasis on you as a sinner, you as a bad person, you as someone who is like, no matter what you do, you're always going to be drawn towards what's bad. I would say that that is an unhealthy spiritual environment for you because it's going to probably lead you to having some of these other mental health issues. And again, this is just so hard to say out loud because you know that it kind of wipes out a lot of different churches and what people are saying from up front. Again, not all churches, not all communities are created equal. You got to kind of shop around for your own mental health.
I think what you're saying is super interesting because you kind of gave two different contexts. You're like, you could see it this way, and that's biblical, or you could say it this way, and that is also biblical. And I think that that's what I have also found in my journey when it comes to narratives of spirituality. Mm. And you've talked about like some toxic narratives versus some healthy narratives that really leads to good fruit beneficially, not only in our own lives, but in those around us. And that's the thing that I found. And this goes back to that stage of like complexity, right? Or perplexity, where it's like, there's actually more than one way to view things, and it can still be spiritually rooted, or it can still be biblically rooted. And so when I hear you say like someone is putting the Bible above the person, right? What I'm thinking is someone's putting their interpretation of the way that they see people over the person, right? They're putting maybe their legalism or their, you know, whatever it is. That's the thing that's been translated for me. When people say, oh no, they maybe use shame or control or hyper-religiosity or what have you that is like harmful to people or spiritually manipulative or abusive, they will say like, well, this is Bible. This is biblical truth. And it's actually, that's your interpretation. Like that's the perspective. Those are the verses that you have selected out to inform your interpretation of how to, you know, maybe abuse, manipulate, control people. And there are equally other verses, interpretations, perspectives that are whole.
Treading on dangerous ground.
Okay. Listen, I'm not telling anyone.
Right? Like what I'm saying is that if you were to say that in some religious environment,
it's
someone's interpretation, because the world that I came from, it's crazy how in 1 million ways they made you feel like the specifically, like, for example, I come from a Seventh-day Adventist background, right? And I still consider myself Seventh-day Adventist and Christian and all of those things, just like very loosely. Yeah. But like, in the context, the subculture of Adventism that I came from, it was like, if you start saying interpretations of the Bible, all of a sudden you're in the realm of relativism. There are no absolutes, and that's shaky ground.
Oh, wow.
Because like, well, now your interpretation, now anyone can say, well, this is my interpretation, and now you have no anchor. So that was kind of a fear tactic
that's
they would
so
use.
That's so interesting.
It would dog whistle that idea of interpretations, because it's like, this is the right interpretation. Like everything, like that was the world, that was the dogma, that was the creed like we were built on, is that the interpretation of Ellen White, our prophet, the interpretation of, you know, like that, this, you know, how we see the Bible and, you know, all of these things, like that is the only interpretation. Oh my gosh.
Well, that makes sense, because I mean that, and here's what's interesting, right? There's over 200 different denominations in the US. There's over 40,000 different denominations within the world, right? And all of these different denominations, they do have a lot of core basis in what they believe, but there are different interpretations when it comes to a lot of detailed things. And what happens is a lot of people within their community believe that, you know, they have the exact right one. And so, you know, for me, I think, again, going back to that relativism, I'm able to look at the church and say, okay, like, there are a variety of beliefs within the church. There's a spectrum of beliefs. And to me, that's not a threat. You know, at the end of the day, the premise, love God, love people. Like, as long as we're, you know, acting in good fruit, you know, that's what matters to me. So, but I feel like, again, you have to be able to go through those developmental stages, you know, the maturity of them and the full development of them to get to that place of harmony, which actually Brian McLaurin calls the fourth stage harmony, where you're able to integrate all this information and have compassion and love for everyone, no matter where they are, no matter where they've landed, and not be led by fear and threats and shame. And so, so for me, it's like, yeah, well, everybody is interpreting it, you know, otherwise if we wouldn't have so many different denominations, if it was that straightforward, you know, and I'm okay
Which is so reasonable. That. Like that makes so much sense, but in, but in certain subcultures, it's crazy how much like that, you know, that's how you're cornered, is by fearing that there are multiple interpretations. When you actually think about it critically, they're like, well, there are like so many different churches, denominations, backgrounds. Why do you feel like you're the, of course, we're always part of the church and the
The one
denomination
that's
that has the right
that only,
interpretation.
yeah, we're the one that's only got it right. Yeah. And so it's so yeah, I think that maybe is a sign for me of unhealthy versus healthy. A lot of times in some of these hyper controlling situations, it's only we have it right. Not only that, but only, it's almost like God is only in our community. He's not really in anyone else's. Everyone else has got it wrong. And so what that does is it leaves you to fear leaving that community because you've been convinced that everyone else has it wrong and possibly couldn't have, some aspect of it being right or what have you. And so to me, that is a fear and manipulation tactic for control. Also, you'll see them kind of shame anyone who leaves, like, oh, they left this community because they're deceived. They left this community because they want whatever it is, they're backslidden, they're whatever, right? Anytime. Anybody leaves that community, something's wrong with them or something's off with them. To me, that's kind of a red flag, that there's control or the idea that only kind of their way is right, in their community. And that makes it hard to leave because in those communities too, you tend to be really tight-knit. It's very familial. So if you end up leaving and going even to a different community, like you said, you could still be Christian or you could still have faith, but maybe you just don't believe every single thing that they believe, or you just disagree on some things, or you want to move to a different community. Even that, it's still that you're still out the box. And so there's no space for nuance. And so it's hard to leave because you might lose community members, you might lose that belonging, you might lose just people thinking of you in a highly esteemed way. You're fearing the way people will think about you. You're losing community. There's so much to lose, right? That to think that someone leaves just because they're backslidden or because they want to. Like, people are losing so much when they kind of step away from some of these communities that it's too much to just bypass. Oh, it's a simple reason. Like, no, something must have really taken place in their thinking and their experience that's not aligning, and they're sacrificing so much to really be committed to that love and commitment to what is true and evident and what have you, in their life.
Yeah, I think the word that comes to my mind when you were talking about all of this is dehumanizing.
Oh, yeah, good word.
Really dehumanizing people, because when you come to any type of community that should be supportive to your nervous system and should buffer you in hard times and should allow you to have a therapeutic faith, it needs to be a safe space. And you cannot have a safe space where you are being controlled and dehumanized based on your choices. I mean, you look at even the Bible and you look at Jesus's life and how much autonomy and individuality he allowed people to have. He never dehumanized people. So, in fact, that was his mission, was to humanize the people who had been dehumanized. So he would go to the outcasts of society and he would touch the lepers and he would talk to the women and empower them and give them roles in work that was really important for, to spread a therapeutic faith. And Jesus himself humanized people. Jesus showed love. Jesus, it's really incredible to me that we very much minimize the ministry and life of Jesus so that we can kind of maximize dehumanizing people through like creating black and white rules about what, makes you accepted to God or not. But when you look at the life of Jesus, his whole life was about humanizing. And if you are in a space, if you're in a church, if you're in an environment where you feel fear if you were to make certain decisions about what people would say about you behind your back. It's kind of now we're going out to we're in middle school here now. I mean, like this is not a safe community. You know what I mean? Like that these are just principles. And I think this is actually part of the problem with society is we have such low standards for what What types of people you should be surrounding yourself by.
Yes.
Like
Yes.
we very much justify the fact that people talk about us behind our backs in church. The fact that people, you know, there's that there's a lot of criticism and judgment, and we're still okay with it because that's where God wants us to be. God needs us to be in this church because that's what we've been told is going to church equals God's acceptance. You know, being, you know, having this community. And the truth is that, yeah, the Bible says, you know, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. So much more, so much the more as you see the day
That's
approaching.
the
God,
way
you
that
know,
I almost quoted that with you.
we can, I mean, like, yeah, I don't read the Bible every single day because it's all in my head already. And especially in this deconstruction process, the parts that have been kind of coming up for me the most of the Bible texts in my mind are the reminders of how Jesus actually lived his life. And so, yes, we do need spiritual community. I think that is very important, but you need to find healthy spiritual community. And that is going to mean that you need to have raise your level of self-love. It really comes back to that feeling of like I deserve, I am worthy of being somewhere where I actually sense the true love of God in my heart and soul, and not I
For
step
me.
into for me. Like not I step into a church and I'm wondering if I'm wearing the right thing, saying the right thing, doing the right thing, what people will think of my lifestyle, my choices. Like, are you kidding me?
Right. Because
That's the purpose of church.
that's a socially
Yeah.
constructed faith.
Right.
Right.
Versus a space where people are allowed to be themselves, are allowed to be in the mess of being human, and where we're actually trying to lead people to having a better view of themselves, a more loving view of themselves, so that they have the tools to make better choices versus the other way around, which is, well, don't go there because that leads to this and the shame and the manipulation. What will people think? And if you do this, then you're not going to heaven. If you know, like God doesn't love you, you're not as spiritual if you do that. All of that, like, let's start putting that on the side of the red flags of a faith and spiritual community as and actually call it out for what it is. Because that's what keeps people in those environments is we allow that too much. We permit it too much. And I've come to the point in my life where to me, what's most important is a spiritual community of humans that don't dehumanize other people, that don't say we have God and they don't. I mean, like, how dehumanizing truly is that to believe that someone is without God because they live in a certain way, have chosen certain things? I mean, that's deeply dehumanizing. And so those are red flags. Those are real red flags that you should be taking seriously. But sometimes that also means that now you're left with like, where do I go from here? And
Well,
we'll
that's what
obviously
I
talk
was going
about that.
to segue into is like, okay, say the person, they are coming out of the unhealthy community, and now you're kind of in this void, right? Because, church just fulfills so many things in your life. It really, I know for me, it just was my whole life. And, sometimes you do go through this where you step away and people are out of church for a little while because they need to actually regain some of these other skills that they weren't able to fully develop because they were in these spaces that totally stunted and arrested their development. When it comes to thinking for myself, trusting my instinct when something's not right, or just being able to differentiate, like I can be my own person and still be in community. All these aspects of that are normal of humanity that are just kind of arrested in development. I feel like sometimes people come out of these environments to relearn these skills so that maybe they can either go back into community with a healthier, more whole perspective of themselves and of life so that they aren't, subject or vulnerable to harm or to a more socially constructed faith that can be more authentic. For some people, it takes letting all these other socially constructed parts kind of fall away so that I know for me, you can live a faith that is sustainable, that is healthy, yes. that is intrinsic, that is not socially constructed, that is not performative. Sometimes people get, you know, need space to be able to reconstruct yes. that. And so I love
that
what you were
saying. That space is a good thing.
Right. But sometimes it's shame. Like, no, you shouldn't be yes. out of community, like you said. But actually right. sometimes people need that space to heal, to rehear or relearn, you know, God's voice for themselves in their own life, because maybe a leader was always, right. we're saying they were the mouthpiece of God, you know, and then maybe that leader was tainted in some way. And yeah. so then God's voice got tainted, you know, and so you kind of need to separate the two, right? And you need to do that by getting out of that space. There are so many reasons why it can actually be healthy to take some time to reassess and heal, and then therefore seek out either healthier community or wherever that leads you, right?
Right.
Because I think a lot of people are also afraid of being in that in-between space and being in that void where maybe they are unclear and they are unsure about what they believe now. And they, you know, some things that they used to believe are falling away, or they're realizing like the communities that they were in were unhealthy, and they're breaking down these structures now, or they're realizing they couldn't trust authority, and authority is actually really human. That's so normal. And right. I think I wanted to talk about like what's normal to feel when yeah. you're in that space where maybe now you have stepped away from the fold, so to speak, or you're rethinking things. You know, it's so normal, like you said, to feel guilt, to feel fear, so much fear, because you have that programming that's telling you you're in the wrong for being mm-hmm. out of the community, or you're in rebellion right. or you're going to hell or whatever it is. You know, yeah. the shame, the doubt, the loss, the grief, because you've lost community. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is with, and now I'm going to come from more of an existentialist perspective, right? This is not necessarily faith-based perspective, but I do think that some of these points are valid. It's the belief that there are kind of four core needs that are to humans, or four core aspects of humanity that we struggle with. So the first is death. The second is isolation. The third is responsibility. And the fourth is meaningfulness. So the first one is death, right? There is kind of a death anxiety that fuels faith sometimes, right? Yeah, the idea absolutely. Of where am I going to go when I die? Because even though we want to live, we all have the reality that one day we will die. And so the stakes are really high when you're thinking about what comes after that. And right. so faith, religion, church kind of resolves that, because they're telling you very clearly where you're going if you do these things. There's a very big psychological safety in that, right? The second one is isolation. And it's the idea that, you know, we want to be connected, but subjectively, we are kind of alone, like in our own yeah. experiences. Mm-hmm. And so church and community resolves that, because we have that connectedness and community, and we're with like-minded people. Yeah. The third is responsibility, which I find really interesting. It's the idea that, you know, we like to have freedom of choice, but also freedom of choice is scary, because it means that we are responsible for our own consequences and for what we make of our lives. And so while we love having freedom of choice, we actually really sometimes want people to just tell us the answers and tell us what right. to do, what is success, what is happiness, what gets us where. We actually kind of want to be relieved of that freedom of choice in a lot of ways, as much as we, right. that is the paradox of choice. And so again, faith, spirituality, religion, church resolves these things, because it lays out God's blueprint for us, right? Of, especially if you're in a right. very, a church that's very structured or legalistic, like this is what you do, A, B, C, D, it'll get you there. That's super yes. attractive. Right. It relieves you of the burden of having to create a life for yourself. Right. and make sense of it. And the last one is meaningfulness. And that is that we want to leave a meaningful life, but apart from like God, religion, faith, there is no inherent meaning in the universe. And we would have to create meaning as to why we're here. That probes all those existential questions of why am I here? What is the meaning? What's right. the point? And faith and spirituality and church, it resolves all those things. It tells us the point of being here, right? And so When you are someone who's gone through deconstruction, or you feel like you're losing your faith or your religion, or you're questioning everything, you essentially lose all of these really core aspects of being human, these core human dilemmas that can really spiral you into an existential crisis because you don't have these anchors anymore that you had, or you're rethinking them or having to relearn or reshape them. So all of that being said, this is why it makes complete sense that you would feel despair, that you would feel like you're free falling or free floating anxiety or panic or any of these things, because you've essentially kind of lost a little bit of these things that really ground us in living life in a meaningful way, in being alive.
Ooh, yeah, that was a lot. And that makes so much sense when it comes to why you feel like your whole world is falling apart.
It is.
When you're going through this process and loss of community, loss of identity, loss of safety. I mean, so many grieving processes that comes with it. And my whole experience when I left that world and started, like you said, taking a step back, even that step back was really scary. But at some point I had to give myself permission to step back in ways that I needed to step back, because I trusted that if there was a God and if God did exist, that he or she had to be more loving and kind and good than, any, human here potentially. And, as parents, if your children are like, going through seasons and stages and different ways of thinking, you don't try to hyper control them into, if you're a good parent, into going, to being perfect all the time. So I had to give myself that permission to step back, have that space, feel all the feelings, all of the grief. There's so much grief. There's also so much confusion because it leaves a vacuum. It leaves a vacuum, which is actually really great, because then you can fill it with things that are very much aligned with you. But in that process of stepping back and questioning and assessing, it leaves this vacuum of who am I outside of this context? Who am I? What are my specific interests, desires, needs that I've maybe not allowed myself to explore and understand, even personality wise? There, I remember going to therapy when I kind of was going through this process, and this woman, this therapist said, everything that you're experiencing, she was kind of, laying it out for me. She's like, this sounds like someone who has been in an abusive relationship, a domestic violence relationship that is coming out. She's like, I've worked with many women. When they come out, they don't know themselves. They were not allowed to have individuality. They were stuck in fear. And so now it's almost like you're almost starting from this blank slate, which is really scary at first. And so much comes with that. And so we're just trying to normalize the experience of, this is a huge loss. This is a massive loss, a massive, space of the unknown. It's almost like someone just propels you into like
space. You're like free floating.
You're like, where do I go?
And it's scary because you don't know where you're going. And I think for us being on the, because I hear this space, this conversation a lot in like faith communities, which is a good conversation to have. But I think for us coming from the mental health therapy side of things, to normalize, like we see this a lot, and this all comes up a lot, like on this side of things in a different way. I think I just wanted to give that perspective that this comes up, I think, more than people realize, all these feelings and everything that we're talking about. It's like, we are not like pulling it out of our butt, you know what I mean? And get this a lot on this side of things. And while there can be grief, there can be despair, it can be hard because you actually really just want to land on something. And this really takes patience and it takes self-compassion, to kind of move through the unknown. And I actually, you know, I think that's what faith is even. Yeah. It's like, you don't know everything. You aren't certain of everything, but maybe, you know, for me, it was like, I am certain of one thing, and God is good. Like, you know, and mm-hmm. God is love. For me, it was like, those are the two things I'm holding on to, you know, mm-hmm. I, as I'm figuring out and unlearning and relearning some of these things, you know, and for everyone, it looks different. Yeah. Like where you land. Some people, they're like, I don't even know if I believe God is there anymore mm-hmm. or exists.
Right.
All of those things are valid, you know? Yeah. And so I think, can we shift maybe to like, maybe some reassurances?
Yeah. I wanted to. Yeah. Yeah. And we were talking about kind of the free fall of, of the whole process. And I wanted to just share a little text that one of my clients sent me that's going through this experience herself for the first time, you know. I think she's in her mid late 20s, like also very developmentally on point there. But she randomly messaged me one day and said, I still find myself crying sometimes when I have thoughts such as, I'm actually allowed to have dreams and desires. Like, what I want is valid and worth pursuing. I'm actually allowed to make my own decisions without feeling paralyzed with fear of going against God's will. I actually have the freedom to build my life the way I want to. It still feels scary and strange, but also so relieving.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was so beautiful when I read it, because it encompasses that realization that God actually like wants our health, happiness, and safety. And God, I believe, you know, in my construct and what I've chosen to believe, that God exists, that God is creative, and that as humans, the hallmark of creativity is autonomy, and you know, the freedom to be creative and create our own lives and have that space. And so I just thought it was so beautiful that you, there is on the other side of that, like starting to find that feeling of relief that like, oh my gosh, like this is actually, you know, I can actually, it's scary, but can I possibly even have like ideas and beliefs and, you know, ways of being that I never thought possible before, which I think is really, really beautiful.
That is, it's freeing, and it's really interesting because it makes me think of like the different ways that people process this based off of where their framework was. Because see, for me, even though I came from a church background and a faith background with both my parents, my dad always instilled in me like never this idea that like God's will was just one straight sure thing that you have to know. I was kind of raised in the belief that like God can move a steering car, so God can make the most out of whatever you choose, or God kind of gives us some aspect of choice and he can be glorified in all of it. So that was kind of my framework. So for me, there was actually still a little bit of like a choice freedom. And autonomy and freedom within my faith. But then you read someone else's like this, where maybe there wasn't that. Maybe it was the constant fear of, no, you have to make sure the choice is absolutely from God and it's absolutely God's will and it's the right thing.
Oh, yeah.
So abstract. What is that? And I mean, even if you Google, like there's so many things about how do I know I'm hearing God's voice? How do I know what God's will is? Like everybody's trying to figure it out. And you have so many people who are prescribing, like, this is how you know. But yeah, I think even that's interesting to realize that a lot of people are just even coming from different contexts and frameworks of how they perceived faith. Some people had more autonomy in their faith than others.
Yeah.
You know, some people's were more legalistic. Like for you, you saying like your holiness was dependent on what you ate. That was not the case. That was not the case for me. And so that's like something completely different to have to work out.
Yeah. And in my context, like we didn't have like, we had these prophecies that were like in Daniel and Revelation in the Bible and like the end of the world and the signs of the times, but we didn't have like people prophesying necessarily. Like we had one prophet who, you know, died 100 and something years ago, but, so it's just so interesting to see how even the nuances of that can create a sort of way of thinking, but like the end, like the common denominator is fear and shame. And so, you know, as you were talking about getting into some of those, you know, reassurances and where can we find a sense of safety When you're free falling and when you feel like everything is like, you know, breaking down around you. And I think for me, one of those spaces was recognizing that the nature of love requires elements of doubt. It requires elements of uncertainty. It requires the space and freedom to know that you might not know everything, but you're choosing something, you're choosing to love. So I kind of think of the fact that, you know, instead of wondering if I don't love God anymore, instead of wondering if I am on a path of like leaving God, now that I'm actually in a space where I allow myself to doubt and have uncertainties and still choose to, you know, believe that there could be something out there that exists, to me, I actually think my faith is developing more strongly, because now I still, you know, choose to believe that God is love, that I am love, that other people are love, and even with the doubts and uncertainty. So it's almost a question of like, did we actually truly have faith before if it was all based on fear?
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. Like a lot of it is a socially constructed faith. I mean, for some people, that's actually what you're deconstructing, right? Deconstructing a socially constructed faith because you realize it was built so much around fear and control in other people. And that makes it really hard to be authentically like your own, even though it feels like it's your own at the time. And so I think for me, some reassurances, and again, we want to make sure we're kind of differentiating that it's not our goal to tell you like a theology to believe or a doctrine to follow, right? Because these are our own, that's not our role. We're not your pastor, right?
That'd be the opposite of what we're trying to
do. That's the opposite of what we're trying to do.
We're just sharing our story so you can understand the context.
I think some people believe, well, if you're a Christian, you need to point them to a certain way. And it's like, that's not our role. I think what comes to mind is just to try to find some of those safe spaces and communities where people are going through what you've gone through. I think it's really validating to understand like, okay, this is normal. Like everything that we've talked about, this is a normal process because you might've been in spaces where they're like, no, this is automatically bad. And they don't realize that there is a developmental process that's taking place that is normal to human, you know, nature and human, evolving and growing up. And so being able to be in spaces where your story can be held, where your experience can be held, and it can be held in understanding and in compassion and in nuance and in complexity, you know, so whether that is through therapy, you know, and having someone to be able to work those things out with, whether it is a support group. Now there's so many online groups of people who have gone through these spaces, you know, and realizing that, you know, I think sometimes what happens too is when you lose some beliefs, you feel like you have to automatically adopt other people's, and you don't, right? Like, just your time to take the space to kind of learn more of like not only yourself, but also what you were told maybe that was harmful or what you are adapting to, but also realizing this was a big one for me. You don't have to leave everything, right? Like you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are probably things that led you to your faith that were really important core values to your life, like loving people, you know, like loving the outcasts, like, you know, being kind, having the fruits of the spirit, you know, like having community, right? There are such, like we said at the start, there are such important and healthy aspects of faith and spirituality to mental health that we can say, okay, these are the parts I'm taking with me that I'm keeping. Right. And maybe these are the parts that I'm leaving behind. They're unhealthy. They're toxic. They're not good for me, for humanity. They don't bear good fruit, right? I'm going to hold on to the things that bear good fruit, you know, as I'm sorting out what this is and what this is going to look like, you know. And you might even have an idea of where you want to land. And this is kind of one of those processes where it just takes time and patience to kind of grow through and get maybe to that commitment phase we were talking about, where you become a little bit more settled on, you know what, this is how I've learned and developed, you know, my worldview where I am now, based off of what I've integrated forward, in all of my experiences and understanding. And so that's, I kind of want to leave it there because I don't want to prescribe anything to anyone specifically, but yeah.
Yeah. I would also normalize the experience of needing to be a little black and white at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's actually very interesting that the type of thinking that got you so bought into this type of world, the black and white thinking, might follow you as you start leaving it.
It's so true.
Which is also the black and white thinking. So you'll see that for a lot of people, including myself, because that's how I was that when I left, all of a sudden, I mean, that black and white thinking stayed with me. Yes. And all of a sudden, everything was bad in my past. And so what you're really trying to, what the real goal here is, isn't to land somewhere theologically, beliefs wise, you know, all of that type of stuff. But really the goal, I would say, from a mental health perspective, is to be able to come to the point eventually where multiple things can be true at the same time. And so, for example, yes, there was an aspect of this that was deeply detrimental to me and harmed my mental health. But also, and I really appreciated the skills of this, this, and this that I learned in that world, or the people that I met, or the person that I became in this area of my life. But I do think that that tends to come in the later stages of
grief. Yes, it takes some time. Yeah.
The later stages of commitment. But just to highlight the fact that it is normal to continue to have that black and white thinking when you leave, because that might be all that you know. And
it's,
that's okay,
so
too, to have that space, that like that stage where you just kind of hate everything. Like that might be kind of like where you need to be. And then eventually coming to the point where you can start seeing things a little bit more nuanced.
I'm so glad you said that, because people forget, like, this is actually grief. And what are some of the yes. phases of grief? It's anger, you know, it's denial, it's, you know, sadness,
bargaining.
And it's bargaining, and it's acceptance.
What,
and
maybe
so,
if I hadn't done this, then I wouldn't have landed here, and then this wouldn't have happened. It's like,
different.
This was just your story.
All this stuff, your anger with the institution, with everyone, that's a part of you grieving. And so I love what you're saying, because some people build their whole new brand or identity around a stage of grief that they're in. Right.
So
you see what I'm saying? So like then maybe they're really angry with the church, which is like valid because maybe they went through harm, but then they build their
1,000%
whole identity around anger, you know? And it's like, I agree with you personally. I think healthy emotional spirituality is being able to get to this integrated part where you're able to say, okay, these things did upset me. I'm really sad about what I lost. Maybe my life would have looked different, da 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 da. But at the end of the day, these are all the things that I gained. These are all the things that I learned. These are all the things that I loved. You know, I try to think about all of those things, and you can integrate it forward. And what that does is that actually gives you a lot of compassion for where everyone is, no matter what stage they're in. It gives you compassion for the person who's still in black and white thinking. It gives you compassion for the person who's angry. It gives you compassion for the person who's sad and feels like they've lost their voice and identity. It gives you compassion across the board because you've been able to integrate all of these parts of you and your experience in other people. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I've seen that where people think that they've left black and white thinking or like fundamentalism or whatever, and they actually just become more evolved versions of their black and white self. Like they're still talking about people, things, issues, like in black and white ways, but it's on another side. And that's so normal. And it can, because
it's
we have
so normal.
Going back to our first episode of this season, biases, we have our biases and they're so easy to fall into no matter where you've landed. And so I think for us, it's really just talking about cultivating maybe a more whole, you know, perspective when it comes through these stages of development of faith, where we've landed, and normalizing it, you know, and just having compassion.
Yeah. And I would just, again, emphasize the fact that just be where you are. If you are in an angry stage, if you are in denial, in bargaining, in fear, whatever it is, be there. You don't need to rush the process either.
Right.
Even as you're hearing us talk and you're like, oh, I should be more understanding. Oh, I shouldn't think more black and white. It's fine. Yeah. This is part of the process. Mm-hmm. Just for once in your freaking life, let yourself be where you need to be right now. If you notice the emotions that are arising within you as anger, don't let anyone gaslight you into trying to speed up that healing process. Be angry. You know, talk about it, write about it, just express it. Let yourself be in that space and let your intuition, you know, your body has inner wisdom to know how to move you through the grieving process in a way that's going to be sustainable. So let it lead you.
Amen.
And don't should yourself into all of these different stages, no matter what we've talked about. Like, just be where you are, where your mind, body, and spirit, and where I believe God and the universe is leading you into a space of therapeutic being and feeling as a human, as a spiritual human.
Amen. And if you believe there is a loving God and an understanding God, you know, there is a verse that said, God knows the way that we think. You know, God would be understanding to knowing why we are, where we are, what's led us there, you know, so that's my feeling, you know, take that or leave that. But yeah, I love what you said. I always say, like, feeling on the way to healing, you know,
yes.
sometimes you got to have the feeling on the way to healing, get it out, yep. You know, grow through it. So,
this has been good.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a good start. We're going to dive into it this month. So stay tuned.
Thank you guys for listening and for also just having grace and compassion and space for us as we sort out and talk through these really difficult and complex, you know, conversations. And hopefully, you know, this will help provide some love and understanding for either those who are going through this process or someone you know who's going through this process to realize that it is a little bit more complex and nuanced and layered that's going on. So thank you for taking the time to listen. Until next time.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, let's continue the conversation and stay connected on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, all linked in the show notes below. Let us know your thoughts or leave a review on the podcast. Your feedback really does mean so much to us. Until next time.